You're listening to a production of the American Council of the Blind and the ACB Special Education Task Force, improving advocacy for students with vision loss in and outside the classroom. For more information, visit www.acb.org.
I'm only a bill, and I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, it's a long...
Hi, this is Tony Stevens, Director of Advocacy and Governmental Affairs with the American Council of the Blind. ACB is committed toward trying to find greater opportunity for Americans who are blind and visually impaired, and most importantly in our schools for our youth and for families of children who are blind and visually impaired. It's part of our mission to try to find ways that they can receive the best quality education. In a sense, it's our future, and we're very much committed to that future. For those that have been listening to part one of the podcast, I encourage you, if you have not yet listened to that portion, where we have leading scholars from the field of blindness and education. It gives an excellent overview about the Individuals with Disability Education Act and other types of legislation that have really helped lay the groundwork towards the rights that our students have in the schools and how we can get access to the best quality education. With us today, we have Mark Reichert, Director of Public Policy with the American Foundation for the Blind. For those that have been listening to part one of this podcast, and if you haven't had a chance to listen to part one, I encourage you, where it has a chance to hear from some of the leading scholars on education of youth and children who are blind and visually impaired in our country. And throughout their conversations and presentations, you heard conversations around things that Congress has done, major legislation that has helped form the way that our children get access to services and supports in school to really help their education. But that is not in no ways a battle that we've yet completely conquered. There's still a lot of work that needs to get done here in Washington. And we're fortunate that there's been some legislation introduced this past year that can really help improve the quality of education and help us understand better what it is that our children and youth who are blind and visually impaired need in the schools. Hey, Mark.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing good, thanks. Good. Thanks for taking time and being a part of this part two of the podcast.
It's a pleasure.
What we'd like to do is really, I guess, in a sense, talk a little bit about some things that's kind of the hot news right now in Washington around education for children who are blind and visually impaired, with the introduction of the Alice Cogswell and Ann Sullivan Macy Act. It's a bill that I'll let you, since you're in a sense very much tied into it and have been working throughout its initial introduction a couple of years ago. But I think what would be great for the listeners to know is a little bit about, why do we even need to have a bill introduced right now? You know, IDEA, shouldn't that have sort of done everything we need? Why do we need more right now?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which we, once upon a time years ago when it first became the national special education law of the land, we called it, Public Law 94-142. Some people know it by that name even more than they know it by IDEA. I mean, the real purpose of that law was to say, public schools, neighborhood schools, you cannot keep doing what you're doing right now, which is by and large locking kiddos with disabilities of all kinds out of your school. And kids with disabilities have a right to a free and appropriate public education just like everybody else in America. And I think by and large, the federal law since 1975, when it was first enacted and now has become known, what we call IDEA now, I think has really done a very good job with that. What we haven't done really well, though, is make sure that kids with disabilities, particularly kids who have sensory disabilities, so blindness, deafness, deaf blindness, or kids who have those disabilities and may have even, additional disabilities, we haven't made sure that those kids with sensory disabilities get the education that's appropriate for their needs once they get in the schoolhouse door. They have a right to get in, and we've done a really good job to make sure they can get in, but we have not really sort of closed the sale, if you will, on making sure that blind, deaf, deafblind, and kids with other disabilities get the education that they need. And that's why we have worked in partnership really from the beginning of this whole effort on our bill that you mentioned, the Alice Cogswell and Ann Sullivan Macy Act, or we just nickname it the Cogswell Macy Act. We've been working in hand in glove with our friends in the deafness and hard of hearing world and in the deaf blindness world, because the needs of blind and visually impaired kids are very parallel to those of other kids who have sensory disabilities, and that's what the bill really tries to do.
Tell us a little bit about the history of the bill. When was it first introduced? What was it that sort of led to having this, you know, a lot of folks grew up to the Schoolhouse Rock and, you know, how a bill and an amendment, you know, is how a bill becomes a law. It's not that way at all. What was, you know, the reality nowadays in Washington? What was the steps leading up to the bill? Maybe some of the advocacy voices, what were they really crying out for? And how did we actually get this to be introduced in Congress?
Well, it's fun that you referenced the Schoolhouse Rock, I'm Just a Bill skit, because I loved that growing up. It's probably one of the reasons maybe why I ended up going to law school. I don't know.
Yeah.
But if you were to watch that Schoolhouse Rock skit about I'm Just a Bill, one of the first lines is this little kid saying, gosh, there's a lot of steps you got to climb to get up to Capitol Hill. And boy, is that true. So this process for developing the Cogswell-Macy bill, just the language that has to do with blind and visually impaired kids, that process, oh gosh, took easily a year and a half, 2 years. And because, so yours truly was the principal author of that section of the bill. And then we've had, you know, colleagues work with us on the deafness and deaf blindness provisions. But, you know, it takes a while to work through. You put specific legislative language together, you write it down, get the specific proposals you want, and then you start shopping it with people who are, you know, experts in special education. I don't necessarily consider myself an expert in much of anything, if anything, maybe in the policy process or legislative drafting. But, you know, what you have to do is to go to the people who are truly nationally known, reliable experts and say to them, does this concept, does this approach, does this pass the laugh test? Do you think this really will have the effect that's intended? And so that process took a while. And then we finally got to a point where we had consensus around the language we wanted to do, and then reached out to our friends in the deafness and deafblindness worlds to say, would you like to join with us on this effort to put together a, you know, standalone, right, single mm-hmm. piece of legislation that embodies what the sensory disabilities community feels are, you know, really past due solutions for kids with sensory disabilities. And of course they were very enthusiastic to join us. So to get to the bottom of your question, you know, sort of the how does a bill become a law and where does this effort fit in? I mean, really the main reason, I would say, other than the obvious reason of, yes, well, of course, we want everything that's in the Cogswell-Macy bill to become law. But in the meantime, you know, and especially since this has been a multi-year process, this is now, I think, the third time that the Cogswell-Macy bill has been introduced in Congress, although this year, and we'll get to this in a minute, this year is exciting because now we have the bill introduced in both the House of Representatives and the Senate, and that's the first time that's happened in a while, so I think we're getting a bit more momentum now. But the real sort of more immediate value of having a piece of legislation like this is that, you know, we've been open and transparent with everybody, not only our own communities, but other communities of folks with disabilities, state and local school administrator folk, our federal government, being very clear that, look, this is, if you want to know what we are concerned about, here's what we're concerned about, and here's how we propose to fix it. And the real point of going to Congress with a bill like the Cogswell-Macy Act is to recruit champions on both sides of Capitol Hill and on both sides of the aisle, as it were, from all, you know, the major political parties, to essentially get them in writing to be our champion for these issues. Hopefully that will mean that they will champion this bill all the way through the legislative process. That could mean that this bill goes through as is, or, you know, as a standalone bill, make it to the president's desk. Just as, if history is our guide, that's not that likely. Usually in order to get things done, you have to kind of glom on to other major legislative packages just because, you know, there's not enough hours in the day, as it were, and that's how Congress does its work. And mm-hmm. so if we were to glom on to something else, it would, you know, likely, most likely be a special education bill, a larger special education bill. And indeed, that Individuals with Disabilities Education Act is long overdue for being reviewed by Congress. And so potentially that may be an option. But the third option is equally as important. And Tony, you and I've talked about this in a number of contexts, whether it's education or healthcare or Medicare coverage. There's more than one way to tackle something. And mm-hmm. it isn't always the legislative process. It's an important part. But since we now have a growing list of champions at the Capitol, in the House and the Senate, and from both political parties, it puts us in a much better position to work with the current United States Department of Education, or even perhaps working directly at the state level to say to people, look, we're deadly serious when we say that there are limitations with the kind of education that blind, deaf, and deafblind kiddos are getting. And we are going to push at the federal level as hard as we can, because that's what we do. That's where we live, and we're going to do what we can to push there. But, you know, here are the things. If you really want to do right by our kids, here's the approach you need to take. And so that's really that third value to the Cogswell bill.
I think that's an important value. I mean, it's great in hearing that, there was a Senate bill introduced.
Yep.
And the House bill as well. What are the numbers again? So folks know, so bills are assigned a certain number that's unique to them. So oftentimes when people reach out to their member of Congress, you also give a House number, which is H.R. Do you remember
the H.R. 1120.
H.R. 1120.
Yep.
And the Senate bill, which was just introduced in the fall, was
S 2087.
S 2087.
Yes.
Okay, so sorry. S, not to put you on the spot.
That's my middle-aged brain was shutting down there.
So S 2087. So those are, oftentimes you can go to the mighty Google and type those in. Congress.gov is a website that you can go to that gives you a list of all the co-sponsors, people that are, as we're calling the champions. It's real important to find out who's championing the bill. And if maybe a person's member of Congress is not championing that bill, the greatest currency for members of Congress are the voters. And as voters, you and your district, if you don't have anybody, it's important to know that this is something that where we can help, like you were saying with that third point, in identifying those champions. They just don't help champion to get bills passed, but
correct.
They have extreme great influence with the federal agencies, with local municipalities, because in a sense they're the conduit by which money flows pretty much everywhere within this country.
Well, and that's right, and this is a really important point, I think, for us to underscore for all the folks who are listening to our mellifluous tones right now, and that is, people will often say, okay, look, I hear what you're saying, Mark. I get, you sold me. This is an important bill, but I've got a busy life. I got a couple of kids. I got a kiddo with a lot of different disabilities. Happens to also be blind. I've got to focus on that. I just don't have the time for it. God bless you in your work, but I would say, look, you can't. Advocating for this bill isn't just about going to Congress and saying, hey, would you please co-sponsor the Cogswell-Macy bill? It isn't just about going to your U.S. senators and saying, please support S-2087, the Cogswell-Macy Act, or go to your House of Representatives member and say, please co-sponsor H.R. 1120. Of course we want you to do that, but here's the thing. Why do something from one reason when you can do it for multiple reasons? When you do that, when you reach out to those members of Congress or those senators, tell them your personal story and say, I have a kiddo who has, this array of issues going on, who's blind or visually impaired and who may have other disabilities. Let me tell you my story about how I've really struggled to get my kid the services that he or she needs. My kiddo needs this, my kiddo needs that. And the school, for whatever reason, has not been providing it. And you put that stuff in writing and you say, the Cogswell-Macy bill, in the long term, that's what's going to make sure that no other kids have to go through this like my kid is. And then what you do when you send that off to Congress, you CC, you copy the heck out of that thing to everyone and anyone that has playing any kind of meaningful role in the education of your kiddo's school career, and you say to those you copy them, the local school administrators, the folks back home. And funny thing, I've seen this happen more often than not. Your letter is to Congress asking them to co-sponsor a bill, but you've told the Congress at this point that your kid is not getting services at the local level that they deserve, and you've copied the very people who should be providing those services. that will, believe me, that will galvanize attention. And that's what you can use then at the local level to say, look, I'm not going to take this anymore with my kid. I'm going to do whatever I can, including going to Washington, D.C., to fundamentally change the system. And that's how you make use of your advocacy, not only to help the larger effort, but also to help your own efforts back home.
Not just reaching out to your members of Congress by calls or emails, but too, if there's a way for you to introduce your child to the member of Congress,
well,
take them to the local district office.
That would be wonderful.
Members of Congress are back for large chunks of time throughout the year. August is a huge time for them to go back and do work. They have recesses around most of the major holidays, and usually once a month they're back for, you know, almost a week, sometimes a little less, sometimes a little more, depending on the time of the year. There's a lot of opportunities, I think, that people don't understand, that when members of Congress get a face and a name, and most importantly, a story, it brings life to the issues that folks are pushing for up here where we just see numbers.
Yeah.
You know, our life is bill numbers and policy, and when you read through legislation, it's oftentimes very cut and dry, and amend this part of the U.S. code and do this and do that. You know, it's very clinical sometimes.
If you're having trouble sleeping, just read a copy of it.
Exactly,
piece of legislation.
But it's when they get that human experience, you know, it really is the thing that they'll come back and they'll, in their speeches during debate, during hearings, they'll get up there and talk about if they agree with something.
Yeah.
And they want it. They want a champion. They want support as much as we need their help and support.
Yep.
So that's a very important thing to try to remember. Where are we standing in terms of, with the next year, we have an opportunity to really try to increase the co-sponsors for both the Senate bill and the House bill. Oftentimes that's tied to messaging. One of the things that's great about this bill is I think both bills have bipartisan support.
Absolutely.
At the top.
Yes.
Which means there's a Republican and Democrats both sponsored it.
Yep.
Which,
by the way, is what took us so long to get a Senate bill introduced, because we refused to move forward in the Senate until mm-hmm. we had that bipartisan support. So.
And you had a senator woman from West Virginia.
Senator Capito.
Senator
Shelley Moore Capito,
yep,
is one of our co-champions, along with Mr. Ed Markey, who's a Democrat from Massachusetts.
So a New England Democrat and an Appalachian Republican,
yeah,
which really is, I think, a testament to the fact that these are issues oftentimes that cross political lines. There's so much heated rhetoric now in Washington, D.C. on certain issues. But when we talk about these things, which in a sense the bill, and we'll talk about maybe messaging in a minute, the best way to talk about the legislation to your members of Congress.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's trying to figure out how to take our special ed dollars and spend them better.
Yes.
And no one's going to argue with that on either side of the political aisle. And I think it's important for folks to realize that, I mean, there are issues out there. As much as people hear, you know, that Congress is split along party lines, it seems like, on everything, there actually are issues that there's some unanimity around, and that they get support. You know, everybody has the risk of experiencing someone in their life that has a disability. Disability does not discriminate against people. It's across all mm-hmm. socioeconomic, cultural lines, ethnic lines, and it presents itself to a lot of people in Congress where you'll be surprised sometimes to find out that a member might have, I remember having a meeting with the chief of staff for Speaker Boehner, and he started talking to us about how his mother was going blind.
Yep. Yep.
And, you know, he was the Speaker of the House, his chief of staff. And then we have other people, talking about their children. You know, they might have a child who's visually impaired or oftentimes with intellectual and developmental disabilities. You know, there are Republicans and Democrats on both sides of the aisle really working towards some of these key disability issues.
Yeah, no, I think that's right.
And what do you think is, how do we talk about it in a way then that speaks to both audiences? What are some of the ways we can talk about it that talks to both Republicans and Democrats?
Well, I mean, I think the point you made just a moment ago about the fact that this bill is not about adding a bunch of new expenses to our special education system, but is trying to make sure that the monies that are being made available are being used effectively, that's a really critical one. And I think that's one that should resound, you know, with both Democrats and Republicans. Stereotypically, Republicans are said to be more concerned about such things than Democrats. I don't know that that's true. But all I would say is it certainly is an important point to make with those offices where fiscal issues, fiscal matters are of particular concern. There are a lot of folks, though, who would say, you know, it's not that I dismiss the fiscal issues. You know, I hear you. That's not going to cost more than what we're currently doing now. But who are much more concerned about sort of the substantive, you know, how well are we doing right now? And a core problem with our special education system today, and it certainly has a, you know, marked effect in the sensory disabilities world, is that we do not know with any sort of degree of scientific certainty, let alone public policy related sort of data certainty, basic questions we don't know the answers to, such as how many blind kids are getting Braille right now? Arguably, blind and visually impaired kids have one of the strongest provisions in current law, in current special education law, having to do with the services that they need. Namely, a provision that says, if you're a blind special ed kiddo, you're getting Braille unless that whole team of educators and administrators and hopefully your parents and hopefully the child, him or herself, decides that Braille is inappropriate for this particular student after an evaluation is done. Well, you know, that's pretty clear. You're getting Braille as the default under our current system. How many kids are getting Braille? We don't know the answer. And if you ask the U.S. Department of Education that question, they cannot tell you. I mean, there are some data sets out there. There is some research that helps give a little inkling into this. But certainly it doesn't tell you whether this kid or that kid is appropriately getting Braille, or perhaps more, you know, to put it more cynically, that their, you know, failure to be getting Braille instruction is lawful. And so we've got to change that. So one of the core things about the Cogswell-Macy bill is that it spells out in no uncertain terms what blind, deaf, and deafblind kiddos need in terms of the full array of services. People sort of assume that, well, you talk about a blind kid, Braille, and you know, you hand him a cane and you pat him on the back, and that's it. And clearly, that's not the end of the story. We know that. And I think we've covered that at some length in these special ed podcasts. But, you know, in addition to that, you can have all the rights in the world spelled out in law, and if there aren't mechanisms for holding people accountable for providing those services and protecting those rights, it doesn't really mean anything. And so I think that's the other piece, right? So the two principal sort of arguments that I think work well, and I don't even want to call them arguments. I guess I would say these are the two, you know, things most in the Cogswell-Macy bill's favor, are that number one, we're not adding, you know, massive expenses to our special education system. Arguably, the special education system in our country needs to be much more significantly funded than it is. I think the number right now is a little under $12 billion. That's $12 billion with a B. $12 billion. It sounds like a heck of a lot of money. Any of us would love to have $12 billion in our bank accounts. But it's a drop in the bucket when you talk about a national system with literally, you know, 7 million students with unbelievably complex needs. But even if we say, look, okay, we're going to do what we can to overall increase dollars, assuming they're available for special education, this bill isn't doing that. What this bill is doing is making sure that we are not throwing good money after bad, and that we're making sure that when those dollars are spent, they are spent for the things that are going to make the most difference for kids with sensory disabilities. And then the other piece, so that's the one principal sort of thing the bill has going for it. And the second thing is that it's not just spelling out, you know, new rights. And indeed, we might even argue that it's not spelling out anything new. It's really specifying all of the things in detail that a blind, deaf, or deafblind kiddo needs to be successful and to really get an appropriate education, and then holds people accountable for providing them.
What are probably oftentimes people aren't experts on everything.
Yeah.
And sure, of course. It's easy for there always to be follow-up questions.
Yeah.
We always recommend that people look at follow-up as an excellent opportunity to build a relationship. Yep. Where you can say just simple, let me get back to you on that. Let me get back to you. Without getting in the weeds on too much of things that, you know, we would encourage people to, and we'll mention some resources at the end where you can find out more about the bills. But what are the two sort of, I don't want to say no-brainer, but the two big sort of things that come out of this bill that would be just real simple talking points on top of that messaging that are the mechanical things that come out of it?
So
you talked a little bit about data.
Yep.
Go ahead.
So I think one of the fundamental problems that blind, deaf, and deaf-blind students are facing through the delivery of special education services, and this is particularly true for kiddos who have additional disabilities on top of one of those so-called sensory disabilities. Mm-hmm. That is that the kids are getting put into disability categories. They're getting labeled in ways that thwart the delivery of those sensory disability-specific services. So if I have a kiddo who's blind, has, let's say, profound intellectual disabilities, may even have some kind of motor issues, whatever, you know, someone might very well come along and in a sort of pejorative way say, you know, gosh, this kid's vision impairment is the least of this kiddo's issues. You know, there are these other things that are going on. So this kid is not a, you know, for the purposes of how special education is going to be delivered for this kid. This kid is not a blind kid per se. This kid is a kid with multiple disabilities first and foremost. That's the label we're going to use. That's the category we're going to put that kiddo in. And when that happens, even though the law is pretty clear that services shouldn't be driven by the label that gets put around a kid's neck, the simple truth is that the way that the system works, that is inevitably what happens. So when we say, what does this bill do and how can we summarize it in short, it's first to make sure that every kid with sensory disabilities, blind, deaf, deaf-blind, is properly identified. We're not micromanaging what the states do with this whole labeling business, but what we're saying to them is, whatever you do and however you categorize kiddos, if blindness, deafness, or deaf-blindness is in the mix, you will acknowledge it formally, you will document it, and you will make sure that that kid has a right then to be evaluated for all of the things that a kid who is blind or visually impaired needs to have, and the Cogswell-Macy bill spells out what those are. And then you will, once those evaluations are done, you will provide those services that are specific to a kid's visual, you know, impairment-related needs. So that's really what the bill is about in a nutshell. It's counting or identifying, recognizing our kids appropriately, evaluating them appropriately, and serving them appropriately. And as I said before, sort of the overarching thing is making sure that once you've established all that, you hold people accountable for results.
Where can people go to figure out more about the bill and the co-sponsors and all that? We mentioned congress.gov, but I know AFB has a lot of resources as well.
Sure. So the American Foundation for the Blind has put up really, I think, a good central hub for a lot of this. If you go to www.afb.org/Cogswell-Macy Act, and that Cogswell-Macy Act has no dashes, no funny characters, and it's Cogswell-Macy Act. Cogswell-Macy Act, afb.org/Cogswell-Macy Act, and there's a fair amount of material up there. We have material both in English and Spanish in terms of talking points, sort of summarizing the bill in a little bit more detail. Again, we don't go into a lot of, you know, legislative or policy minutiae up there. But, you know, if you visit there, you'll not only see, you'll be able to get to the bill text itself, if you'd like to look at it. But you'll get these talking points I'm describing, and we even have little scripts up there to use if you're reaching out to a member of Congress or their staff, and, you know, basically kind of, you know, what things to say. And I want to follow up on something, Tony, that you said, which I think is really important for people, and that is I continue to be amazed, and I bet you do too, at how many people who, especially people who've never done any kind of advocacy work before, they really, I think, get nervous or scared about the idea of doing this work, because I think they think there's a certain level of expertise or polish that's required. And, you know, look, we'll let others judge, Tony, if you or I have any polish, but, you know, the simple truth of the matter is people who don't have the Washington, D.C. Shine about them, if you can call it that, or Greece, I guess, might be another way. But the people who don't have that inside the beltway kind of persona, namely real people who call up their members of Congress, drop them an email, make a visit in person, Tony, like you were talking about, and come in and say, look, I don't know anything about all the detail, but what I've heard about this bill I think is amazing. I know it's going to have some direct relevance to what my kid should be getting. Let me tell you what my current story is. By the way, member or staff person, I'd love your help right now, you know, maybe getting connected up with some people to maybe get my kiddo some better service right now. But you know what? We got to do more. We got to do better. And that's why this bill is important. And if they say, well, gosh, what can you tell me? You know, I understand what you're saying about kids being classified in various disability categories. Tell me more about that. And you might say, gee, I honestly, I really don't know. I'm no expert in special education. You know what? That's a good thing. You come across as authentic. You're being honest. You're being open about what it is you know and don't know. And Tony, as you said, it gives you an opportunity to say, you know what, but I'm going to get you an answer. And I'll put you in touch with Tony Stevens at our, you know, consumer organization up in D.C. Or I'm going to forward you a link to the American Foundation for the Blind's website where you can get more information about it. And that's another way to stay in dialogue with these people.
I got nothing else to add to that, man. Words to live by. You know, it's the greatest voice oftentimes in Washington is the voice of the constituent.
Yep.
And those get attention a lot more times than the voices of those that are inside the Beltway. So, you know, encourage folks to go to afb.org/CogswellMacyAct. And it's an opportunity, I think, in a lot of ways for us to really take some small steps. But when we gather those steps enough collectively, we can move together as a large group pretty effectively.
Well, and let me also say, as God is my witness, ladies and gentlemen, Tony didn't put me up to this for sure. We didn't talk about this in advance. But let me put by way of full disclosure, I've been a member of the American Council of the Blind, Tony, your organization, for a long time, and a life member, really, for, 22 years, I think. There you have it. But I would really encourage people to come to D.C. and participate in ACB's legislative seminar. It's one of the few opportunities, I think, that people, men and women who are blind, but frankly anybody who is concerned about the needs and capabilities and rights of blind people, you know, can come to D.C. and in person make your case with lawmakers. And look, regardless of how any of us feel about these wild and crazy days we live in here in Washington and throughout our whole country, I mean, this is an opportunity for blind Americans and people who care about them to step up and be heard. And it's amazing to me, you know, when we've done these Capitol Hill activities and people have come to Washington, the tangible results that you see. Sometimes they're more dramatic than others, there's no question. And these are long-term efforts. You know, you don't just come to D.C. once and all of a sudden a bill gets passed. But I will tell you that in all of the major pieces of legislation having to do with blindness and vision impairment that I've been involved in over the course of time, almost all of them have hinged on having, you know, maybe not just one, but maybe two or three, a handful of real people, real consumers, not people like Tony and me doing this stuff professionally, but people who really come in, from out of town, tell their story, and that there's just nothing like it. So I know, you know, we're recording this session here in December of 2017. I don't know if you want to talk about
it. We're having our mid-year, So we're having our mid-year conference where our presidents from our affiliates come in at ACB. And if you're not a member, we always welcome new members. But we have a legislative seminar, which is a day-long conversation on advocacy, how to get involved at home, how to address the issues that we think are our priorities for 2018. And then on the Tuesday after the last weekend in February, so what is that, maybe February 27th this year, I think,
That's it.
We'll be hitting the Hill, and we help people schedule their meetings with their member of Congress. Sometimes we sit in on some meetings, you know, with key members and their staff.
And y'all do this every year, and right about
we do
that
do it every
time,
year. Yeah, it's usually February. The last weekend in February.
Yep.
And for those that can't get involved, we try to find ways on that same day to you know, post on your member of Congress's Facebook page or tag them in a Facebook post or a Twitter post, and really try to find ways to engage people collectively. So we'll be looking forward to letting folks know about the Senate bill up on the Hill, And, you know, I would encourage folks, yeah, it'd be great to get you out here, but we understand it's a cost. And if you can't make it out here, we can still find ways. If you ever want to try to get in touch with your member of Congress and you're a member of ACB, we happily work to get our members in touch with their representatives. You can email advocacy@acb.org. That's advocacy@acb.org. And we'll do what we can to put you in touch with your member of Congress.
That's excellent. So, with any luck, if I were king, I would love to have ACB have this issue as one of its priorities. I guess we'll find out. I know it's a tough road to hoe these days, right?
It's still early in the year, but it's great news that it was introduced in the Senate, so we'll definitely be having it on our plate.
Yep.
And so, you know, we're looking forward to have some things to ask for this year. I mean, we always have to you know, in a sense, go into sometimes defense mode and talk about issues of what we need to try to fight and protect.
Yeah.
What's great about Cogswell-Macy Act is how we can make things better and improve the lives of the future generation of Americans who are blind and visually impaired.
Well, and one of the things we haven't talked about, and it's a little beyond the scope here, but we can't be naive about the fact that, you know, we're living in tough fiscal times in terms of a federal budget standpoint. And, you know, one of the ways that we can defend the spending that we have been making available in the special ed system is to make it crystal clear to people what that money is being used for productively, and quite frankly, where we need to improve. Because if we say, look, we're grateful for the money we have and we need to preserve it, but you know, clearly there are some substantive improvements that need to be made to the system. The notion that you're going to come along and rip the rug out from underneath the special ed system, or frankly anything else for folks with disabilities, and that somehow people are still going to get a level of service that's appropriate to them, is just crazy. And so, you know, I think whatever the particulars of what we talk about, I think clearly we're going to have to be, as you say, aggressive advocates for kids with disabilities and kids who are blind or visually impaired.
Aggressive, but I like to always quote Dr. King. And an advocate that reminded me once that Dr. King never said, "I have a complaint, but I have a dream." And I think it's important to stay positive on the message, and also to really remind ourselves that, going back to when you were just talking a second ago about, you know, sort of fiscal austerity in our new times here in Washington, this is a way to be able to say, look, we can do, with what we have, we can do better.
Yep.
And it's just finding ways to tweak the system.
Yep.
We don't need to go out and start throwing money.
Yep.
But we can take what we have now and we can really, really improve the lives of students who are blind and visually impaired in this country.
Yep.
So we're looking forward to working with folks. Go check out afb.org/Cogswell-Macy Act and email advocacy@acb.org for questions about this. And be sure to check out part one of this podcast and special education series. And Mark, thanks so much for taking time. Man, it's been great.
It's
much appreciated.
It's really a pleasure to do this. I appreciate being asked. Thanks so much.
Woo, you sure got to climb a lot of steps to get to this Capitol building here in Washington. Well, I wonder who that sad little scrap of paper is.
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, it's a long, long journey to the capital city. It's a long, long wait while I'm sitting in committee. But I know I'll be a law someday. At least I hope and pray that I will. But today...